Okay. So I want to finish off this course, or mini course, I guess, with a discussion of magnetic monopoles. And these are objects for which E equals zero and B is equal to this, or G R hat over R squared. In other words, instead of the electric field falling off like 1 over r squared, the magnetic field does. And the problem is, how could we get such things? Because Maxwell's equations force the divergence of B to equal 0. And so people generally thought there could not be any such things, but Dirac in 1932 realized you could get such things in quantum mechanics provided a certain condition was satisfied. So how do we do that? Well, let's try and see what this would imply for the vector potential. So we can write Fij is epsilon ijk bk. And so the only non-zero component here is the r component, the radial component, in spherical coordinates. So if that's radial, these have to be the theta phi pieces. So we get epsilon theta phi r b sub r. But this is a tensor density. So it is equal to the square root of r squared sine r to the fourth sine squared theta times this thing here, which is g divided by r squared. That's the r component. And so this cancels that, and we're left with the theta phi component being g sine theta. And so now we want to solve this. We want to, this means dA d theta a phi minus d phi a theta is equal to g sine theta for the vector potential. And we have d theta a r minus dr a phi is 0. And we have the other one, dr a theta, I'm getting ahead of myself, dr a phi minus d phi a r is also equal to 0. So now we want to solve these equations for a theta and a phi and a r. Well, we can choose that to be 0. And if there's no radial dependence in a theta and a phi, that will go to 0. And then if you integrate this equation up, if there's no phi dependence, that goes to 0. So there's no phi dependence. We choose this, and we have no r dependence. So then it's not hard to see that the only non-zero component is a phi, which is equal to a constant minus g cos theta. And so a mu is 0, 0, 0, k minus g cos theta is the answer. Or in form language, we would say a is equal to a mu dx mu, which is equal to k minus g cos theta d phi in form language. So this all looks not so terrible, except the problem is that phi is not defined at theta equals 0 or pi, which means a phi must vanish there. And now we see we do have a problem. A phi at theta equals 0 is equal to k minus g, and a phi at theta equals pi is equal to k plus g. So we can choose the constant of integration k to get rid of one of those things, but we can't choose it to get rid of the other. So if we did, if we wanted it to vanish here, we would choose a to equal g 1 minus cos theta d phi. Here we would choose a to equal g 1 plus cos theta d phi. But we can't have it both ways. If we, or can we? Well, actually, we can have it both ways. That was Dirac's insight. If we write it in Cartesian coordinates, this looks like 1 minus or plus z over r times x dy minus y dx divided by x squared plus y squared, that thing we saw before. And this is equal to infinity when z is minus r, and it equals infinity when z equals plus r. So I got to get my minus plus right. This is infinity. If I choose the minus sign, there we go. So in other words, on the this is the positive z axis, and this is the negative z axis, if we write it that way. So either the gauge field is singular, literally infinite, on one of the half z axes. And so this is called a string singularity. Sometimes called a Dirac string singularity. So, can we have it both ways? Well, the answer is yes. So Wu and Yang pointed out, well, what if we do this? What if we say A is G 1 minus cos theta d phi, for theta is less than 3 pi by 4, and what if we say, in fact, let me write it like this, the vector potential will be the 1 minus cos theta solution for theta smaller than that. So this is the north pole, and this is the south pole region of any sphere centered about the origin. In which case, no matter which one of these we pick, we get that F is G sine theta d theta wedge d phi, or f theta phi is g sine theta, which is what we need. Remember, we go way back here. This is equivalent to that for the magnetic field. So one could say, and I think actually there is one minus sign missing here. That's a minus there. And I left out a minus here. That's a minus. K has to be minus G. So, well, how can you have two different solutions? Well, if we take A, so we can call this A north. Move this over a bit. This is a north. This is a south. And so a north minus a south, as long as this is the gradient of some scalar, then these two are fully, this whole thing is an acceptable solution because the two different potentials differ by a gauge transformation and the theory is gauge invariant. So the cross product of A north, or rather, sorry, the curl of A north will then equal the curl of A south, which means they're both equal to B, the magnetic field. Well, if we do that, if we take A north minus A south, then we get 2 G d phi is equal to grad chi dot d chi, or dx, sorry, dx, dx. And the solution for this is that chi is equal to 2 G phi, which is not single value. So, yes, they differ by a gauge transformation, but it's not a single-valued one. As theta wraps around by 2 pi, chi changes. As it wraps around by 4 pi, it changes again. So chi goes to chi plus, under a 2 pi rotation, chi goes to chi plus 4 pi g, as phi goes to phi plus 2 pi. So we don't have a clearly defined gauge transformation classically. So we have no single-valued gauge transformation classically. But we can have some such thing quantum mechanically. So we have I d psi by dt in Schrodinger's equation is minus 1 over 2m grad minus Ea squared psi plus some potential acting on psi. That's Schrodinger's equation. And so if A goes to A minus grad chi, if I make a gauge transformation here, then this will equal A minus 1 over E, E to the I, E chi, grad of e to the minus I e chi. That's just a different way of writing this. Then, of course, I have a gauge invariance provided the wave function undergoes a phase transformation. So this is now the gauge invariance of the equation. So now, what about single-valuedness? Well, all I need is for the wave function to be single-valued. That's good enough. And I can do that if the following happens. So I do need a single-valued wave function. So that means psi goes to e to the minus e chi, remember, in this case is 2g. So I've got 2eg phi psi. So I need psi at phi plus 2 pi to equal psi of phi. Well, the only way that is going to happen is if e to the minus 4 pi eg is equal to 1. And therefore, 4 pi, can you see this here? Yeah. 4 pi eg has to be an integer. In other words, 4 pi eg must equal 0 plus or minus 1 plus or minus 2, etc. And that is the Dirac quantization condition.
Do you mean that 4 pi eg has to equal 2 pi times it?
Times 2 pi, my apologies, yes. I should, let me do it this way, 2 eg is an integer. Or eg is 0 plus or minus a half, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 3 halves, etc. Sorry. So that's the Dirac quantization condition. Yeah.
So why do you say that chi, it's not single classically, but quantum mechanically it is single valued? Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is it doesn't, I mean, this is a classical quirk. One might say maybe it really doesn't matter, but the non-single valuedness of chi can be just reabsorbed into the wave function provided that's true. So classically, one tends to think that all functions we use should be single valued. Quantum mechanically, we have a bit more freedom because all we need are wave functions to be single valued. That's basically the philosophy here.
But classically, you know, chi is not an observable quantity, so it can be multiple valued.
That's right. So you could argue that doesn't really matter.
Right.
That's correct. So turning it around, one can just say quantum mechanically, chi will not make, the only way the gauge transformation makes sense is because of that, because the wave function has to be single valued. So, this string singularity, what is it? Well, the picture is like this. We have a vector potential that is 1 minus cos theta, and if I had a coil of wire that current was flowing through, I have a magnetic field coming out like this, and the field lines would go the other way. They'd go back around to the inside of this thing, and that's what we understand an electromagnet to be. But if I take a really thin solenoid, and I make it infinitely long, then the field lines spew out of it everywhere, just as though it were a monopole, provided, of course, I ignore this line. So this is an infinitely thin and long solenoid. So it's as though you could take a coil of wire, make it as long as you like, make it as thin as you like, wrap it as tight as you want, and in the limit this goes infinitely thin and infinitely long, you get a string singularity. And then the argument in gauge theory is that you can always gauge rotate this out of the way. So you do your physics here in one gauge, you do your physics here in another gauge where this solenoid is on this side, and then the solenoid actually does not technically exist. And the argument here says you can do this provided the quantization condition is satisfied. So this is, if you like, the kind of physical picture of a solenoid. It's like magnetic fields spewing out of the end of a north pole. I suppose you could think of it like a bar magnet, right? A little, when you were a kid, right? Just take a really thin, long bar magnet. If it's so thin and so long, the south pole is infinitely far away. All you can see is the north pole, and you can never touch the bar magnet. If you try to, it just means you've gone to another gauge. The next concept here is that a dion, which is a particle with both E and G non-zero. So it's an object that has both electric and magnetic charge. This quantization doesn't mean a particle must have non-zero electric charge. You could have a monopole with zero electric charge and non-zero magnetic. It just means the value of the magnetic charge is given by in units of inverse, half inverse fundamental electric charge. So, what are the properties of a dion? Well, we have Maxwell's equations in vacuum. They have actually a symmetry called a duality symmetry. If E prime is equal to E cos alpha plus B sine alpha, and B prime is equal to negative E sine alpha plus B cos alpha, where alpha is some constant, then E prime and B prime satisfy Maxwell's equations. Yeah?
What happens to this argument when you consider quarks that have like thirds?
Well, then the fundamental unit of the monopole would have to change. So I guess a quark monopole would have to have, they'd have a factor of a third there, basically. So it's whatever you call the fundamental unit of charge associated with the wave function. We'll look actually a little bit at that indirectly. I'm not gonna check this, sorry.
Isn't that still inconsistent? Because this says another way that the ratio of all the charges has to be like even or I guess not. Actually,
If you let E go to a 30, then for the electron, everything will get scaled up by a factor of 3. So it's not hard to check this, actually. It's the divergence one should be obvious. The divergence of this is just the divergence of that plus the divergence of that, and both of those vanish, so that one vanishes, and the same for the bottom. And the other one at the top is only a marginally more work. E prime cross B prime is equal to E cross B, and E squared plus B squared prime is equal to E squared plus B squared. So the energy of an object does not change, nor does its pointing vector. So if a dion has EG, then there are two duality invariants. We have E1, E2. So let me write it this way. Suppose I have two dions of charges E1, G1, and E2, G2, then E1, E2 plus 4 pi G1, 4 pi G2 is a duality invariant. And likewise, E1 G2 minus E2 G1 is a duality invariant. So both of those things are duality invariants. And I want to write this, I was a little bit, let's see, I've got this quantization condition redefined by a factor of 4 pi. So I want to rescale, it's common to actually rescale the units of g by 4 pi, which is why I had the pi thing up there originally. So that's what these things are coming from. So in this language, the quantization condition is 4 pi eg is equal to an integer. So here, if I switch E1 with 1 over G, if I let E1 be 4 pi G1, or sorry, I'll let 4 pi G1 be E1 and 4 pi G2 be E2, and then I switch that, this is the same, and then likewise, this will be the same. G2 will become E2, E up to a factor, E1 will become G1 up to a factor, and then we'll just get the same thing. So, so the quantization condition becomes for a dion, you get 4 pi times G1 E2 minus G2 E1 is an integer, and this is the only duality invariant that obeys the quantization condition is that thing. So the other one because it's a product of E's and G's, we can't incorporate the quantization condition into it, but we can for the second one. So a dion has that quantization condition. So what about the non-abelian case? So the non-abelian case, actually, now the equations are the Yang-Mills equations, which explicitly look like so. And they have the solution that A is equal to Q times 1 minus cos theta d phi. And this may be given as an exercise, but you can show in spherical coordinates for some group, in fact, for any group, that this is indeed a solution. So it's just like the abelian case, except Q is a matrix that would be an element of the gauge group. Whatever the gauge group is for the theory. And remarkably, this is unique. There's a theorem by Godard Noitz and Olive that shows these are the only monopole, magnetic monopole type solutions to Yang-Mills theory, are these analogs of the abelian monopole. So now we want A minus A prime to be pure gauge. whenever the two regions overlap. And that leads to this quantization as e to the 4 pi q times e is equal to unity. So that means q has to be a certain kind of matrix. Yeah. Is Q, yeah, that's a good point. Let me check. Q would be, yeah, it would really be the algebra. Yeah. So this matrix has to have the property that when you exponentiate it like that, you better get the identity. So maybe when I mean one, I really mean the identity. So, one example is SUN.
Is Q Hermitian or anti-Hermitian?
Well, I'm gonna show you. It's gonna be anti-Hermitian. It's gonna be anti-Hermitian. So, in the case of SUN, it's minus I over 2. And it can be diagonalized. So we write the eigenvalues as little q, and it would have to be traceless because it's in SUN. So the sum of the q's have to vanish. This n is this n. And so this condition means that each of the q's have to be integers. I should say the EQIs each have to be integers. If I normalized, if I could absorb E into the definition of Q, but really each of the EQIs would have to be an integer, where this is the, I should be careful, this, maybe I should call this G, that'll get confusing. This is the gauge coupling constant. Which is often called G in Yang-Mills theory, but I didn't do it here because I call the monopole charge G. So in units of the gauge coupling constant, these things are all integers. Suppose I take SUN, but I mod it out by ZN. That means now that Q is an element of the algebra of SUN over ZN. And so let's write, we can still diagonalize it. We'll write this now as Q tilde, which is I over 2 times the diagonal matrix of a bunch of Q tildes. But now, the difference is that Q tilde is identical to e to the 2 pi I m over n, Q tilde, since we've modded out the nth root of unity. So in other words, if I multiply all of these, if I multiply this whole matrix by this factor where m and n are both integers, then it's equivalent to the original q because I've modded out by Zn. Yeah. Well, the algebra. Yeah, Yeah, that's right. And you can write it like this. I said the algebra, I didn't write it. Maybe I should write little s u n. So you can write it actually as the diagonal of a bunch of q tildes that have the property that they're equivalent to each other when you multiply them by that, and that's due to that identification.
SU2 mod T2 is SO3, right? And we know those have
I'm going to do that next.
But if these things have the same algebra, then why does anything change?
Well, when you exponentiate this thing, you get an element in the group, and that will make a difference.
Exponentiate.
Question?
Yeah.
So for the SUN over ZN, Q tildes are still real numbers?
I'm going to tell you what the Q tildes are. I haven't got there yet. So the Q, capital Q tilde is equivalent to itself when you multiply it by that. And so now we've got e to the 4 pi QE equals the identity becomes e to the 4 pi Q tilde E is equal to the identity. And that tells us that the QI tildes are M over N plus an integer. And M is equal to 0, 1, 2, etc. So let's push that up to the top. And then to mention the last example, SU2 versus SO3, which is SU2 mod Z2. For SU2, Q is equal to I over 2, Q 0, 0, negative Q, which is minus I over 2, Q sigma 3. And this leads to the condition EQ is equal to 0, 1, 2, etc. But for SO3, I've got a matrix Q tilde, which is minus I, 0, Q tilde, 0, 0, minus Q tilde, which is minus I over 2 Q tilde sigma 3. And now by that condition, I'll have, I don't know why I wrote it underneath, I might as well write it here, minus I over 2 Q tilde sigma 3. So now the quantization condition is EQ tilde is 1 half plus an integer, or of course it could be an integer, so it's really an integer divided by 2. Any half integer will work for SO3, but here only integers will work. So that's the distinction. I sort of get twice as many monopoles as I otherwise would get. So, these monopoles are topological in character in the sense that the charges can't be anything we want them to be. They have to obey these quantum properties due to the fact that we've got a north, these quantization properties due to the fact that we've got a north pole and a south pole vector potential or gauge potential that when they're fit together give a non-single value gauge transformation that affects the wave function. So people realized you classify monopoles via their topology, the topology of the gauge group. So let's consider the path ordered exponential of this integral. Which is this. So this P means path ordering. And the only book, at least that I know of, that actually explicitly spells out how you would grind this out at a computer is a book by Steve Carlip on 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. And he has it in the appendix if you want to see it. I'm not going to write it out here, but he actually explicitly writes what it means. I mean, one can intuitively perhaps see what this means, but to actually grind it out through a machine, he explicitly writes it out in an appendix on his book on 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. It's in an appendix. Maybe it's in another place, but that's the only place I know where someone's actually brute force written this out term by term so you can see what it means to path order every term. After a few terms in the exponential, you get the idea. But I found it helpful. Okay, so G is an element in the group G, and it depends on the line integral from A to B. So what you have, of course, is I have some initial point, I have a path to some final point, and I am adding up values of the gauge potential along this field, however they may go. So I take the value of the gauge field here, and I multiply by a little bit of distance there, and then I do the next value at the midpoint of the next segment, and I multiply them together and add them up and take the limit that these little chunks go to zero, and that's and I have to keep the path between initial, any path between the initial and final state ordered in terms of the exponential, because I'm doing this many times, yeah.
So I can think of this as a, like a spatial version of the Dyson series.
In some sense, yes. Yeah, in some sense, yes. So, so what about a monopole? So let's have a sphere and let's integrate from some initial place to some final place on a sphere. So G of tau will be P times the exponential of e to the minus a mu dx mu, which is going to equal P times the path ordering, that's what I mean by P, path ordering of the exponential of e to the minus e 0 to 2 pi of ds, and then it'll be a phi d phi by ds, where a phi is somewhere on one of these blackboards up there, I guess. A phi is given by the monopole solution. So that's all well and good. Where it gets interesting is when we take a closed curve. Where the final point is the initial point. So we wander around the sphere somehow, and then we get back to where we started. Well, now we have a closed loop integral, and by Stokes' theorem, this is the integral of the field strength over the surface that the path encloses. And this will be the integral of Q sine theta, d phi, if we're on a sphere, integrated over whatever it is that is enclosed. So for example, if I have a path that wandered around like this, so this is xi equals xf, and this surface here that is on the sphere that's enclosed is what I would call d of tau, yeah.
So here we're not taking a to b, the algebra value, right?
Well, this, at the moment, let's, the abelian. Yeah, we'll do the abelian one. So this will be a path of length r of tau. So this thing around here will have length r of tau. Oh, and the tau comes in. Well, the tau is given by that. So I should, in this case, in this example, before I close the sphere, I get tau in there. When I close it, in some sense, I'm going to be able to take tau equal to 2 pi. So if we take a path, let's take a path that goes from the North Pole, and let's go down some distance theta. Let's go over some distance 2 pi tau in the phi direction, and then let's go back up to the North Pole, like so. Then the integral, in this case, the integral of a mu dx mu is going to equal, by this theorem, the integral from 0 to theta, q times the integral from 0 to theta of sine theta d theta times the integral from 0 to 2 pi tau of d phi, and that's just going to equal 2 pi q times 1 minus cos theta tau. If I go all the way to the South Pole, then I get the integral of a mu dx mu is just going to be, well, when theta's pi, I'm going to get 4 pi q times whatever the tau is. It's obviously a limiting procedure. But what that means is that this group element will be e to the minus 4 pi tau, q times e to the minus 4 pi tau, q times e. And this is a map from S1 into the group.
So what is tau in that case?
Well, yeah, so you've gone all the way down to the South Pole, and then you go back up along some other meridian. So you would have to take, for example, a limit where tau would go to 1, and in that case you would have a map from the group to G. I guess I should have written tau equals 1. So the idea is, tau takes the range 0 to 1, and when I do that, if I take the limit as tau goes to 1, then phi ranges from 0 to 2 pi. So what I imagine is taking this down here and bigger values of tau, and eventually I can go all the way around and circle the entire globe as tau equals 1. So when tau equals 1, then I have a map from the circle to the group, and so this will classify what the monopole is, because the charge times E obeys this quantization condition. And so you get various classes. So these maps from S1 to G classify the monopole. And they're called, the classification is given by the homotopy group, which is the group of all maps from Sn to G, if I have an n sphere, so pi 1 is the group of all maps of the circle S1 into the group. And while I did this for the abelian case, you can do it just as well for the non-abelian case, and you'll get the same answer. So the pi's are a measure of how connected the group is. What do I not need? I think I'll push the mid up here. I think I'll put this guy here, and then I don't have to rub off any more blackboards. So so pi 1 is a measure of the connectedness of G. It's a measure of the connectedness of a group. If pi 1 event, or for that matter of any space, here it's a group, but the map of a circle into any other space, the pi 1 of that tells you what the connectedness of this space is like. So it's a measure of the connectedness of x more generally. So if pi 1 of x equals 1, we say it is simply connected. And what that means is really what the words say. It's simple to connect any point to any other point, which means if the space X is simply connected, a path between any two points is continuously deformable to any other path between those two points. There's no obstruction to wiggling a line. If you imagine taking two points and joining them together with a piece of yarn or string, or elastic, you can stretch this any way you like through the space and literally get every possible paths. P1 and P2. P1 is continuously deformable to P2. If the simply connected case holds. So this is simply connected. But otherwise, this is not the case. So multiply connected means there basically is a hole or a handle in the space. So suppose I have a space, but it's got holes in it, like a pretzel or something. Then if I have a path from here to there, and I have another path from here to there, P1 is not continuously deformable to P2. And here, pi 1 of x is not 1. In other words, it's not a group with just one element. So really, multiply connected means there's more than one way to go from here to there that's non-trivial. Whereas simply connected means there's only one way to get from A to B. All ways are equivalent. Yeah.
So what does it imply for the monopole?
So I'll get to that. So for the monopoles, so for abelian monopoles, Q is equal to the negative of IG, and EG is N over 2, and N is an integer. So G of tau is equal to this quantity here, which is e to the 2 pi I tau to the exponent n. So this n is the winding number. Of the group that we saw last time. So as tau, or not last time, but earlier this week. So as tau goes from 0 to 1, we wrap n times around the group. G of tau winds n times around U1. So a monopole is an object, if you like, whose vector potential wraps around the group more than once, non-trivially. Or at least, maybe I should say once non-trivially. So magnetic charge is topological charge. And so pi 1, so the classification for non-abelian groups is given by pi 1 of G, and there are, I'm pretty much out of time, so the bottom line is to is the pi's for all the groups are classified, and they have upon exponentiation, you can get simply connected groups, and these groups have centers. So for U1, the group is R, and the center is R. I'll mention this in a minute. For SUN, the simply connected group is SUN. The center is ZN. For the symplectic group, SPN, it's the same as its simply connected counterpart, and its center is 1 and negative 1. But the orthogonal groups are a little bit different. Their simply connected component is called spin n. And for SO 2n plus 1, it's spin, called spin of 2n plus 1. And the that's the two elements. I don't have any other elegant way of writing this. Mapped to 1 in SON, and the 2 mapped into negative 1 in two elements in SO, 2N and SO 2N. And here the center is the same thing, but to SO 2n plus 1, SO 2n plus 1. So
do you mean spin 2n?
I mean spin 2n. My apologies. Yeah. I mean spin 2n. So every distinct Lie algebra can be exponentiated into a group that is simply connected. And if you mod out by the center of the simply connected group, you will get a non-simply connected group, and then you can have a monopole. So the example, is it still on the board or did I hide it? Oh, it's up there, SU2, SO3. So SU2 is simply connected, but as a center that is Z2. It turns out, if you mod out by that center, then you go down into this case where n is 1, as it turns out, and you will get that Z2 taking two elements of the spin group and mapping them into SO, SO3. So that example is there. So in general, so this is sometimes called the covering group. And I'm pretty much out of time, but you'll get monopoles for G equals G modded out with K, where covering group, I'll call this G bar. So you'll get monopoles whenever K is a subgroup of the center of G. So not an L. This has to be a subgroup. So so that's the example I said before. If G bar equals SU2, K equals Z2, G equals SU2 mod Z2, which happens to be SO3, then you'll have something that is not simply connected, and you'll get that classification. I guess in the last minus 2 minutes, I'll say there's one other thing to note. Most monopoles are unstable. Not all, but most. And the reason is that if you choose higher topological charges, it turns out they're all unstable to decay into the smallest non-trivial topological charge. So really, there's only one stable monopole in each topological class. And I don't have time to discuss that. One stable in each topological class. And one can demonstrate that using properties of partly of the type that I've had here, and looking at the quantization condition. Basically, the simplest stable monopole will have either trivial topology or wrap around once, and the ones that wrap around more are basically able to annihilate with other anti-monopoles that are around. And basically what they'll want to do is just wrap around the least number of times they're allowed to do within their topological class. That's what they like to do. Yeah.
So the top polyhedral monopole, is that an SU2 or?
That's the SU2 monopole.
So according to this table, how does that fit into this table? Its charge is classified by an integer, right? Or
I'm trying to remember. I think it's the one in SU2 mod Z2. I think it's classified by the half integer. In that case, there's two. I had this written here, but I was going to, well, I'm out of time. For SO3, for that example up there, we have the half integer classes. Okay, so we think maybe if I can bring this down. Oops, wrong one. So we have these half integer classes in that case, but pi 1 of SO3 is Z2. So there are two distinct classes, one where the exponential of the 4 pi q is unity, q tilde is unity, and one where it's minus unity. So the unity one is given by q tilde equals 0. which is the trivial class. The only way to get minus unity is to choose the half integer here, so you get e to the I pi, and then you'll get the other one. And every other, all the monopoles have to be in one or the other. And so either the only stable situations are either no monopole or one monopole, and that's the Tupolyakov thing, a single monopole. So if you have, I mean, you then have to ask, I guess, well, how unstable are they? Maybe if you formed in the early universe some really complicated monopole with a lot of topological charge, then you'd have to put in more physics to say how long would the silly thing take to decay and so on. But they would all have higher energy than the within their topological class than the one with the smallest winding number you've got. And either, so in the case of the SO3, you either have no wind, you have either integer or half integer. Well, the simplest integer is zero. There's no monopole. The simplest half integer is a half. Okay, that's it.